miles north of Champaign, which includes large rural areas. In rural Illinois, students often live many miles from their school. Galindo says less money could put the burden on parents to drive their kids, either to the bus stop or to class, which he says would result in a domino effect. He says more students might skip class more regularly, and because the state gives less money to districts with higher absentee rates, the district could see further funding cuts.
That's counterintuitive. How do you institute more programs and at the same time saying, we're going to cut your funding?
We, being politicians in Springfield, despite the proposed $145 million reduction in bus funding, Quinn's budget spokesman, Abdon Palish, says the governor is committed to getting students to class on time, but he could not offer any indication of how the governor might help districts make do. Palish says Quinn also proposed cutting school transportation funding last year, but that was averted because Illinois instead used money it saved by closing state facilities. He says this year, there's no choice but to cut money from education.
There's no good options here. When you cut money to education, do you cut classrooms, teachers, buses? That puts more of a burden on the local school districts, which is not a good option. So we're just one of the least bad options as we look all over the budget for where else can we cut.
But Republican Senator Jason Berkman of Bloomington sees political motives. Downstate schools, which can cover large geographic areas, are more dependent on state funding for buses. Berkman says he believes Governor Quinn is taking a lick at downstate districts as he prepares for a re-election run in 2014.
Those areas tend not to support the governor in election races. I doubt they're going to support him much next year. And he realizes that and thinks it's an easy constituency, I presume, to target.
Berkman also says the governor's proposal is just that, a proposal, and that there is still a ways to go in the budgeting process. Legislators, not Quinn, get to write the budget and decide how much money to put into education transportation. I'm Chris Slaby.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WYLL. The Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago is home to Sue, the largest and most complete Tyrannosaurus rex fossil discovered to date. And while it's known for that and serves more than a million visitors every year, the Field Museum, like many cultural institutions, is struggling to rebound as the economy does. The museum is now considering some controversial ways to raise money, and NPR's Cheryl Corley has this report.
The first thing you see when you enter the main hall of the Field Museum is Sue, the largest T-Rex specimen around.
A woman fossil hunter founder, Sue Hendrickson, and Sue and her dog were out fossil hunting, and they saw the backbone sticking out of a ridge in South Dakota.
A crowd gathers around docent Jan LaRiviere as she talks about the world's most complete T-Rex fossil found.
She was 28 when she died.
28?
It. 28? We don't know if it's a girl or a boy. It was 28 when it died.
Oh.
The Field Museum's encyclopedic collections range from dinosaur skeletons to taxidermy exhibits, which include the infamous man-eating lions of Tsavo that terrorized a railroad camp in Kenya over a century ago. In all, there are more than 20 million biological and geological specimens and cultural objects, but only a small portion are ever on display. In 2002, the museum board approved issuing bonds to add an underground collection center and to update other areas of the field's ornate neoclassical building. Joanna Vorankovich, a research associate at the University of Chicago's Cultural Policy Center, says back then other institutions were doing the same thing.
Before the economic decline for the arts and cultural field, it was a time at which it felt like you could do anything. You could plan a multi-million dollar project and there wasn't a substantial risk of having to suffer any major consequences.
Then the stock market tanked, and the field's endowment took a hit, says Richard LaRiviere, docent Jan LaRiviere's husband. He also happens to be the museum's CEO.
If you think you've got to cross the street to get to the restaurant on the other side and you get run over by a car, you think, why did I ever want to go to that restaurant? And we've been hit by a car, like every other institution.
The field had predicted big increases in attendance. That didn't happen, and it fell short of its fundraising goals. There have been layoffs and other cost-cutting, but the museum's budget is still $5 million in the red, and a good chunk of the budget is slated to pay off its bond debt.
And at the time that those bonds were issued, all the smart people were doing that, and no one could have anticipated what would happen in 2002 and then again in 2008.
LaRivière inherited the problems. He became CEO late last year. By then, the Field had auctioned off some of its collections. The sale included 30 paintings by George Catlin, a celebrated 19th century painter of American Indians and the Old West. LaRivière said curators had determined the paintings weren't essential to the Field's research mission, and the focus of the institution had shifted.
Such that to keep items that you're no longer actively curating is really to diminish their potential value to the public, to the scientific world, etc.
Later, the museum sold the rest of its Catlin paintings and earmarked the proceeds, more than $15 million, to pay for certain staff salaries and for buying artifacts. Selling off items in a permanent collection, or deaccessioning, as it's called in the museum world, is fairly common. But there are generally accepted guidelines among curators as to what you can do with that money.
And in no event should those proceeds be used for anything other than acquisition or direct care of collections.
That's Bert Logan with the American Alliance of Museums. The Field's LaRivière says the museum followed those guidelines and will do so again if it needs to sell off anything else.
It's not the sort of thing where we would say, well, we need another $100,000 to balance our budget this year, so let's sell this box of ants.
The problem is that box of ants could have been part of a prize collection bequeathed to the museum with the expectation it would stay there forever. And that, says Carol Joynes, co-founder of the University of Chicago's Cultural Policy Center, is what makes deaccessioning so tricky.
Because it makes donors in the future fear for the security of the things they leave to the organization if, say, they leave a significant collection, and seems to many to skirt with a breaking of a trust or a vow to take these things into permanent protection for future generations.
The Field Museum isn't just a repository of stuff, though. Its research operation is world-renowned. CEO LaRivière says a study of its collection of peregrine falcon eggshells, for example, helped ban the widespread use of the insecticide DDT. Now, as one of the country's premier cultural organizations works to climb out of its financial hole, it faces the imminent loss of curators and scientists who have less than a week now to decide whether to accept early retirement packages. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. Internet shoppers, get ready for something called the Marketplace Fairness Act of 2013. This week on Legal Issues in the News, Christine Hurt explains why online purchasers may start costing a little bit more in sales tax.
If you are thinking of buying something expensive from an online retailer, you might want to do that sooner rather than later. Before the end of the year, that purchase may cost you up to 10% more. 45 states and the District of Columbia currently impose a state sales tax, and cities within those states may add an additional cent or two. For those of us in Champaign, the total Illinois state sales tax plus various city-county taxes is 8.75% on general merchandise. In Chicago, the tax is 9.25%. However, for the past 15 years or so of internet shopping, even Illinois residents who made purchases from some online retailers have been avoiding paying that sales tax. Though sales taxes are an obligation imposed on the consumer, retailers are supposed to collect and remit the tax. However, retailers with no physical presence in a state can't be compelled to collect those taxes. If a retailer doesn't collect sales tax on a purchase, the consumer is legally obligated to remit the tax themselves, but very few, if any, do. So, purchasing a $1,000 television from Amazon will save an Illinois resident about $90 over the same TV in town, or even online from Best Buy or Sears, stores with Illinois locations. Traditional brick-and-mortar retailers have struggled to compete with online-only retailers who have a near 10% discount every day, particularly if shipping is free. The other big losers under this regime are the state and local governments who lose tax revenue. Illinois estimates it loses $169 million a year, and the nationwide total may be as high as $20 billion. However, Congress is stepping in to help states regain some sales tax ground. The Marketplace Fairness Act of 2013, if passed, would require online retailers to collect and remit sales taxes based on the delivery location of goods purchased. If there is no delivery location, for example, in the case of a book or movie download, then the tax will be based on the billing address. Interestingly, Amazon, which has been the obvious beneficiary of tax-free online retailing, is supportive of the legislation. After years of fighting states that have tried to force Amazon to pay sales tax, the online giant is a cheerleader for the act. Perhaps this is because Amazon has recently entered into voluntary arrangements with 9 states, including large markets such as California, New York, and Texas. Building warehouses in these states, where it is now taxed, has allowed Amazon to ship merchandise cheaper and even faster. And Amazon may have established such a loyal fan base of customers addicted to its convenience and fast shipping that it doesn't fear losing customers over price. So who is against internet sales tax equity? Online-only retailers that aren't nearly as big as Amazon, and the portal that serves them, eBay. Though the act exempts small businesses with no more than $1 million in revenue, that threshold leaves medium businesses with a price disadvantage and new compliance costs. Therefore, some groups argue that the $1 million threshold could be raised to $10 million without states losing much revenue, while giving needed relief to small to medium enterprises. In addition, certain groups such as the Heritage Foundation and anti-tax watchdogs oppose the act as just another tax increase that will hurt consumers. However, the act adds no new sales tax. It merely enables enforcement of what is really tax evasion. This is Christine Hurt.
Christine Hurt is a professor of law at the University of Illinois.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Swires Land and Management Company, Danville; eAgco Incorporated, Fairmount; and Cannon Farms, Camargo. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 6th of May, 2013. The Works Progress Administration, created on this day, 1935, by Franklin D. Roosevelt, the biggest agency in the New Deal, employed about 8.5 million unemployed people, building roads and highways, repairing and constructing bridges, public buildings, parks, airport runways. It's the birthday of Orson Welles, born Kenosha, Wisconsin, 1915. At the age of 21, he was hired to direct a New York production of Macbeth, went into radio, directed radio plays. It was his 1938 broadcast of War of the Worlds that made him internationally famous. 3 years later, Citizen Kane came out. He was the writer, producer, director, and the star of the movie. It didn't do great things at the box office, but now considered one of the greatest films in history. And then his career started to go south. He had a number of box office failures in the 40s, The Magnificent Ambersons, Journey into Fear, The Lady in Shanghai. Orson Welles, who said, "I started at the top and worked my way down." It's the birthday of Sigmund Freud,